important in a conference like this, in which most of us represent non-governmental organizations. It's important for our perspective and our networking to understand that it is not only people in non-governmental organizations who are sensitive and responsive people. And so at a conference like this, I think it's a tremendous privilege for all of us to have that rehearsed by the mayor's presence. And so I'm going to call on Al Lingo of Atlanta to introduce our honored guest. And come on now, Al.
My dearest colleagues, it's an honor for me, for Kailash, and for Kyra Lingo to introduce for us all another presenter. This young bud of a new flower, which is our common future, perhaps shall find a caring gardener in this next presentation by Andy Young. I believe that it is a wonder-filling event that we are all on the threshold of the doorway where we are beginning to be willing to receive help from others. During our long march and dark nights, we have come to realize that all of us share some form of addiction which we have used to pace ourselves. Not only has our dependency enabled our journey over these last three decades, but it appears that we have also awakened to the reality that our structures and our spirit traditions have dulled our sensitivities and kept ourselves from experiencing our own power and the power of the universe too fully. I believe that our next speaker intends to be a helper to us, to speak in such a way as to enable our building a trust in ourselves and in the universe. I believe that he is here because he believes that a common future for the planet does reside in people like ourselves from across the world who become increasingly willing to experience our own power and strength. He is here this year and at this place because we are becoming willing to receive help, and because he knows that this willingness to receive help gives our common body a chance to heal and our common spirit a chance to be heard. Now, who is Andy Young? Today, the Honorable Andrew Jackson Young is widely recognized as the mayor of Atlanta, Georgia. He is celebrated for his outstanding performance as an innovative promoter and a confident manager of what is becoming, through his leadership, the next great international city of the world. Throughout his life's journey, the Reverend Andrew Young has been grown up in the conviction that indeed with God all things are possible. Trained as a congregational pastor, he has served his church in Thomasville, Georgia, and has been a part of the dialogue on religion and race through his work in the National Council of Churches and through his assignment by his denomination to the World Council of Churches. Andy Young was assigned again from the established church to join the civil rights movement to work with Dr. Martin Luther King. Today, he is seen in many parts of the world as an extraordinary man, for he has helped change the social fabric of the United States. And as the executive director of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, he was Martin King's most trusted and able aide in the struggle for civil rights and in the nonviolent resolution of conflict during the 1960s. As a peacemaker and a politician, Andy has rewritten history by becoming the first black congressman elected from Georgia in the 20th century. Andy played a critical role in pulling together the Democratic Party to elect Jimmy Carter president of the USA, and he served as a cabinet member during the Carter administration. Andy has represented the international interests of the United States as ambassador to the United Nations. And he has remained throughout his 6 years as mayor of Atlanta, an influential voice in the Democratic Party. And his leadership was a key factor in the party's decision to hold its national convention in Atlanta. Andy Young is a vocal spokesman for an expanded and revised U.S. role in the global economic system. He is a vigorous opponent of both U.S. aid to the Contras in Nicaragua and of the deplorable and devastating system of apartheid in South Africa. Andy continues to address critical policy issues in the developing world through his Washington, D.C.-based nonprofit organization called Young Ideas. This man was born in New Orleans, Louisiana, on March 12, 1932. He's a graduate of Howard University and of Hartford Theological Seminary. He's received numerous awards and honorary degrees throughout his career, including the Presidential Medal of Freedom, America's highest civilian award. Andy is a son, a brother, an uncle, a husband, and a father. In the wider family of the globe, he is a sort of guiding servant on the planet. Andrew, you have spent a lifetime on the cutting edge of social change and spiritual care. I present to you my dearest colleagues, and my dearest colleagues, I present to you our friend, Andy Young.
Thank you very much. It's an honor to share this occasion with you, for I see this as the kind of occasion from which many good, strong trees will spring and bear many good fruit all over the world. There is a sense in which I, too, claim some spiritual connections with this strong tree of faith which you represent. For as a college student, just after college, with no sense of direction whatsoever and with no clue to my vocation, I ended up in a little conference in Texas, going there largely to drive my preacher, and not intending to stay in this conference at all, but planning to go to visit my college roommate in San Antonio to spend the week partying with him or some other more frivolous pleasures. And instead, as things are in Texas, I found myself 200 miles from San Antonio. And in those days, I was scared to death to drive there by myself. And so I ended up staying at this conference. But I met a small group of young people there who happened to be the first white people I had ever met, whose religion had influenced them enough so that they were willing to accept me as a person in spite of the color of my skin. Now, we take it for granted nowadays that people of different colors and cultures can come together as one happy family as we are today. But this was 1951. And we had a long struggle to wage from that point. But in those earliest days of that struggle was something that I knew only as the Austin Faith and Life community. I knew of a fellow by the name of Joe Matthews that everybody loved and who seemed to love everybody. I somehow attribute the warmth, the vision, and the Christian commitment of these young people. I was back in Texas a few months ago, and I looked for some of those young people because one young lady's father was the sheriff of her county. And she said that he would probably put her out of the house if he'd known that she had anything to do with any kind of conference where black people were in attendance. And yet, I didn't get to meet them, but I heard that they were all doing well. Most of these young people were concerned, though, about doing something for somebody else. It was the first time I'd run into particularly a group of young people who understood that the meaning of life or the purpose of life was to do something for others. And so I've always had a romantic fascination with the kind of life that you live and the kind of work that you do. I really and truly do think it's the basis of the kingdom of God. It's the reaching out to people. And you never know the impact of a life when you touch it. I'm sure at that time, nobody could have imagined that they were going to help set me on a road where I would end up going to seminary, working with a Martin Luther King, and all of the things happening to me that have happened. And I doubt very seriously if those things would have happened if I had not been touched by a cadre of individuals, all of whom seem to be influenced in some way by faith. And nobody attempted to evangelize me. Nobody attempted to get me to sign on a dotted line. Nobody attempted to get me to do anything. They just shared with me their love of life and their vision of the future. And I think that's been one of the motivating factors in my life, throughout my life. And it's a belief that if somehow the power of God through individuals could do so much with me, and I have hardly done anything to deserve it, except be willing to go to strange places at strange times and do what at the time seems like ridiculous things. And yet it has always worked out for good. And so I guess I'm a firm believer in the words of the New Testament in Paul, that all things work together for good, for them that love the Lord and are called according to his purposes. And I guess I don't ask what the future might be. I only want to know where we are now and where we seem to be needing to go in this moment. And that's what I think you're attempting to do. And when people come together from the kind of diverse linguistic, cultural, religious, ideological, emotional backgrounds that you represent, the very fact that you stay here for a week or two means that something wonderful is bound to happen. Because in a very real sense, you are the world in microcosm. And the kinds of tensions that you experience amongst yourselves and with each other are basically the kinds of things that normally people fight wars over. In fact, in many places in the world, there are wars being fought over divisions that are far less diverse than the divisions which exist in this room. I mean, we think it's ridiculous now that in Northern Ireland, Protestants and Catholics are at war. We don't fight Catholics anymore. Catholics don't fight us anymore. Though the first fight I had as a boy in New Orleans, Louisiana, was with a little Catholic boy over the Lord's Prayer. But we've moved beyond that. Wars are being fought over the varieties of faith, between the various types of Islam. Wars are being fought between Christians who are black and white in Southern Africa. And we have learned in many places of the world, particularly in Atlanta, that it's possible for people to live black and white together, and to be actually strengthened by the diversity in our midst. And so as we learn these lessons for ourselves and simply exhibit them, I think we do make an impact on the planet in which we live. Now, I want to share with you a little bit some of the things that I'm doing. I really do want to save time for questions and discussion. But I find myself having been pushed along this road. I I went along with Martin Luther King simply because it was the only thing that I could do as a young minister. I saw that as breaking down the dividing walls of hostility that the book of Ephesians talks about. And they talk about between Jew and Greek. But for us in America, it was clearly black and white. And there was a legal barrier that had to be broken down in order for our society to survive. And once we began to engage in that without violence and find a response, that was where I met Al Lingo in St. Augustine, Florida, where in trying to get a civil rights bill passed, we found ourselves in the midst of a demonstration where literally the police force and the Ku Klux Klan had merged. It was just open season on anybody black or anybody that wanted to be in an integrated environment. Out of the beatings and out of the brutality and sufferings which many achieved and jailings in that period, I think we did help to pass the Civil Rights Bill of 1964, which radically changed the southern part of the United States. But following the death of Martin Luther King, I found myself looking for somebody to run for Congress. And nobody was there. And everybody who could pull together blacks and whites politically didn't think it could be done. And they turned to me and they said, well, if you believe so much in that, why don't you try? And it took us two times, but we did. And it wasn't long after that that, I'll put this in the context of the American election, because I know right now lots of people are discouraged or despondent about the way the elections went, and our politics is very confusing. But it doesn't bother me, because I was elected to Congress in 72, went to Congress in 73, the very same time that Richard Nixon beat George McGovern, and the McGovern was running to end the war in Vietnam. And there was a landslide victory crushing him. But in 8 months after we were sworn in from in Congress, a Congress moved from the point where nobody would stand up against the war in Vietnam to by the middle of August, where the Congress of the United States cut off the bombing of Cambodia and effectively ended America's involvement in Vietnam. So that there's a strange way in our politics that no matter who wins the election, the agenda of the loser ends up being very much on the, it becomes very much the agenda of the administration in power. So it's almost as though, you know, we saw it with Ronald Reagan. I mean, we go from the Soviet Union as an evil empire to the best relations that the United States has ever known with the Soviet Union. And there was nobody that could have been more dovish about the Soviet Union toward the end of his administration. So that you don't really have to worry about our country a great deal. In spite of what it seems like, there's a residual strength there that somehow the power of the people does seem to prevail regardless of who wins the election. And I think the same thing would have been said about if Michael Dukakis had won, George Bush's agenda would have probably been pushed by the Congress. Because one of the things I think we do as a country to survive is put the balance of powers before any one particular power. And we're afraid to move too fast because we're so big and we're so powerful, and a wrong move could destroy the planet. You almost have to look very carefully at what is actually happening and not just take what the press says or count the votes. Because, well, even counting the votes, even though there was an electoral vote landslide in many of the key precincts and many of the key states, the big electoral vote states, 10,000 votes either way could have swung them another way. So the thing that the American people did was cast a very firm vote for middle-of-the-road, do-nothing policies. But that's a reflection of a people who are scared to death of the world in which we now live, where the early optimism of the United States being able to solve all of the world's problems is gone, and where there are forces out there that we don't fully understand, and where many people have lost their nerve, and we have a kind of isolationism that, we saw also in the wake of Watergate. But Jimmy Carter coming along in the wake of Watergate suddenly took the country to new levels of communication. And I happened to be a part of that. And that's another thing. I was supporting Morris Udall for the presidency and it encouraged him to run. But Jimmy Carter was my governor. And I was making a speech across the street from the dinner where he was announcing the fact that he was running for the presidency. And no other elected official showed up. And the headline in the Atlanta paper was, Jimmy is running for what? And it was such an embarrassing situation that there was no elected official, nobody of any stature or significance, to even present the man who was offering his candidacy as the next president of the United States. So they came across the street to the hotel where I was speaking and asked me would I come over and introduce him. Well, when you're introducing somebody who's running for president, you're sort of morally obligated to introduce him as the next president of the United States. And so I crossed both of my fingers behind my back, and I crossed my legs, and I said, forgive me, God, for this one. And I went on to speak about Jimmy Carter and why he should be the next president of the United States. And you know, I convinced myself. Only because it suddenly dawned on me that the South of the United States had been the part of the world that had made the most progress in dealing with the problems of race and poverty. I mean, we have seen the southern part of the United States, where I grew up, go from very primitive, no electricity, no running water, outhouses rather than indoor toilets. And we've seen in less than 50 years the South become amongst the most advanced parts of the planet on which we live. We've also seen the nation that fought a war over race suddenly come together and come to grips with the terms of racial difference. And it was Southern governors that led this transformation. And so I suddenly realized that out of his sufferings and experience, he probably would be able to help reconcile some of the world tensions. And what happened, in fact, I doubt that anybody else trained in the diplomacy of what's those famous schools? Georgetown Institute or Fletcher School of Diplomacy. They train you for negotiations. But what Jimmy Carter did was not negotiation. It was reconciliation. And he got Sadat and Begin off by themselves. And he got them to think about the problems of the other. And he literally forced them to become brothers. In spite of the differences that were pulling them apart. That's what we were able to do with, in Rhodesia, we were able to help blacks and whites to see that they were brothers. And I was confident of being able to do that because I discovered that Ian Smith was a good Presbyterian layman, lay preacher, and so was Joshua Nkomo. But also, Dabaninghi Sithole was a minister of the United Church of Christ, and Robert Mugabe, a Roman Catholic school teacher for 17 years, and a devout Jesuit. Abel Muzarewa, a bishop of the Methodist Church. And I felt like there was a common ground. There were times when it didn't seem that way. And one particularly fierce time when the negotiations were very hostile. And I was sitting on the side of the table with the British. The British, just sparks. I mean, I ended up being the mediator not only with David Owen and Joshua Nkomo and Robert Mugabe, but also being the mediator between the British and Ian Smith and Vorster then of South Africa, because we had to bring all of these people together. But their common ground of survival turned out to be greater than the differences which were pulling them apart. I say all this to say that as a result of some of these experiences, I became convinced that there is almost no problem that human beings can't solve if they will take the time to understand it at its deepest level. And the mistakes that we made as a Carter administration, we made because we didn't believe enough in what we were doing and we didn't move fast enough. I always argued with the intelligence analysis that was coming to the president from the Central Intelligence Agency, because I was getting information from my friends who were missionaries. And the missionaries always had better information. And it was always more sensitive and more accurate. And it was nowhere more in evidence than in the discussions on Iran, where my missionary friends were telling me that the Shah was in trouble, and that if we really believed in human rights, we would urge the Shah to move to a constitutional monarchy and to empower the middle class and give them some decision-making capacity in Iran. And he said if we didn't, there was going to be a revolution. Well, when you say revolution, I think of communists. And that's what the CIA was thinking. And of course, there were no communists of any significance. But what he was talking about and what he said was, but the revolution is in the mosques. Well, who ever heard of a revolution in a mosque? You know, it's a ridiculous notion to intelligent, well-educated people. And yet, that's perhaps the most revolutionary force on the face of the planet today, is the revolution that's coming out of the mosque in the form of Islamic fundamentalism all over the world. But that's related to what's happening to us too. And I was into this to kind of say that I got swept into all of these things as Carter got swept into the presidency. And if we could have moved faster, if we could have understood better the power of these forces that were moving, we might have been able to relate to them. But we were so much too tied to the formulas of the past. And we were much too handicapped by our own fears and our own insecurities and our own lack of personal experience in living in other parts of the world. I think I had more than most because of my contact through the churches. But even those Foreign Service officers who become experts in our country very seldom have the kind of first-hand contact in the countries that, say, you have. So their understandings and their ability to deal with those forces is far more limited. Now, I think there's one other thing I'd like to say there, though, that I see those forces that we see in the developing world, that crying out for religion, as also something that's happening in the West in another form. And I don't mean to equate the two, and I don't mean to draw two direct parallels, except that what you see in Iran and what you see in Algeria and what you see in the north of Nigeria and what you see in the Sudan is people who have been rushed into the 20th century and on the verge of the 21st without the spiritual and cultural strength to understand these phenomena. And rather than become completely uprooted and become, you know, technological man, there's almost a rebellion in search of the Spirit. And the thing that I hear more than ever before, unconsciously, the cry of our generation is that man, nor woman, nor child can live by bread alone. But that ultimately there has got to be some reconciliation of the Spirit and technology. And that Islam has not been able to do that, not even attempted to do that. And we've done it to a greater extent in the West. But even so, it was unheard of when I was in college, in the height of the era of men of reason. Nobody went to church. And you were almost ashamed to admit that you grew up a Christian. In fact, being an educated, sophisticated, young collegiate meant no time for religion. And yet on our college campuses now, some of the most active participation we have, apart from football and sports, is Bible study. And then when I go to a campus like Duke University to speak in chapel and find that there are 500 students every Sunday morning in breaking up in Bible study, that's not something that could have happened when I was in college. But what we're seeing is another version of what you see in the world today. And I think that what you have done is somehow move with technical competence, with organizational and management skills, but with a spiritual foundation to take on some of the problems of the world in which we live. And I think that's very, very much what the world is crying for. Another friend of mine who's a Chinese expatriate living in Singapore has been involved inside the People's Republic of China, and he's been starting churches, but he doesn't call them churches. They're more community centers, and they don't have crosses. They simply have the word love across the top in Chinese. And what he's been doing is bringing in young technocrats with Christian background to come in and just help to train people to solve problems. That's very much what the world is crying for. A coming together of people out of a spiritual foundation to try to deal with the technical and infrastructure and community organization problems that plague communities, states, regions, and the planet. Now, believe it or not, that's what I think I do as mayor. I still think that I'm a preacher. And I still think that, you know, Atlanta's a church with 2 million members. It's my job to help them to kind of live together, but it's also my job to feed the hungry and to clothe the naked and to heal the sick. But in our society, I've found a way to do that by attracting large amounts of capital. And I found that the best way to get people fed is somehow a free market system that allows food to be mass produced. I know there are many problems with that, but all of the theoretical and theological problems don't compare with the fact that, you know, people are eating and eating very, very well. I figure as they're eating well and as they continue to grow, as long as they're eating well, they can work out the spiritual problems and the environmental problems and everything else. But that I have sort of put myself in the position almost on the opposite end of the spectrum of trying to find the macro economic solutions to problems. And we have just found that people in the world are generating more money than they know what to do with. So we are inviting them to bring it to Atlanta. And they're coming. Over the last 5 years, 6 years, we've attracted $67 billion worth of new investment. That's more than has gone into the whole of Africa and Latin America put together. And that's wrong. But people won't put it in Africa and Latin America under the present circumstances, under the present level of turmoil. And they are looking for some place to put it. We've tried to fashion Atlanta as something of a city that will begin to be the city of the 21st century, a kind of a city that's half black and half white, that has opened its doors to its Asian and Hispanic minorities. And because we solve the problems of black and white, we figure that the Asian and Hispanic problems are a piece of cake. Because they're coming in more gradually and they're integrating more successfully. But we are working toward becoming a world city. Now, that leads me to the question of what are we going to do about the other areas? Another thing is we're not getting a lot of government assistance. All of this money is private money, and it's generated over 500,000 new jobs, and you know, and so far the city and the metropolitan area is working. But I don't know why we can't do that in other parts of the world. That anywhere you can guarantee social stability, social and economic stability, there is surplus capital that can be attracted. And it can be attracted on terms that are favorable to the local community. Now, there is a Japanese group that, and I have a paper here that was written by the president of the Mitsubishi Research Corporation. And one of the things that they're advocating is a global infrastructure fund where over a period of 20 years, some $500 billion would be collected and assembled and be invested in private projects that would run $10 to $15 billion each. Now that fascinates me because there are one or two projects that areas I think I know a little something about that I know that $10 or $15 billion worth of private capital in those regions would cause an economic takeoff that would be comparable to what we've done in Atlanta. One would be a natural gas pipeline that went across the Sahel that would pipe the natural gas that's now being flared off in Nigeria and Cameroon and take it up and sell it in Europe. The gas would pay for the pipe, but it would also pay for the roads, for the electricity, and the fresh water going all across the Sahel. If you had electricity, roads, and fresh water going from Cameroon all the way up across the belly of Africa into Algeria and Tunisia, and with the natural gas going under the Mediterranean into Europe, the very fact that you built that kind of infrastructure would create the possibility of just the fresh water alone would wipe out 27 diseases in Africa. Just the presence of roads and electricity would open up that part of the world to farming and also to the development of mineral rights. There are all kinds of other investments that would follow, but that $10 billion would have to be guaranteed not only by the governments along the way, but it would take a guarantee by the United States and Japan and the European community. But the technology is present, the natural resources and raw materials are there, The capital is present. The only thing missing is the politics. And as a politician, I'm always looking for some, you know, big wingding that I can pull together that'll solve a whole lot of problems. Now, even as I say that, I would hate to see the kind of rape and exploitation that would occur along one of those projects. And the reason I tell you about it is that if any of these projects come into being, I would hope you would be related to them too. And I would hope that, for instance, another one is another canal of some sort. A second canal across Panama or Nicaragua. But just the idea, it could be a land-based canal. A canal that is a series of conveyor belts and pipelines that would connect to ports on two sides of the Isthmus of Panama. But it's the kind of project that would pay for itself. But in the process of constructing that conveyor system across the Panama Isthmus somewhere, the infusion of $10 to $15 billion worth of capital would bring people from all the way up in Mexico down to work. You would actually pay people more to do that kind of work than the armies are paying them to fight. You would have the Contadora group, more than just an ideological or visionary coalition, you would have them with some economic and political muscle. And so I guess another project that they talk about is a hydroelectric power generation system in the Himalayas that would prevent the floods in India, but use that water power to generate electricity and to irrigate lands. And they're things that we know how to do. And they've got a list of about 50 such projects where the engineers have done much of the feasibility study and where it just requires that the politics be put in place. Now, I guess I don't really feel that anxious about the world in which we live. I think times are hard enough in the United States so that we're not going to be able to come out of our deficit unless we have some kind of global economic stimulus like this. So it may not be this, but there's going to be something that will do for the developing world what the New Deal did for the South in the 30s and what the Marshall Plan did for Europe and Japan in the 50s. In the 90s, I think we're going to see some kind of global development. But that global development's success is going to depend in large measure, well, I shouldn't say the success, but the quality of that global development in its macro engineering or economic projects is going to depend in large measure on the capacity of local leadership to influence and control and to derive benefits through the planning, through the construction, and through the development of anything that's done. And I don't know a group of people who are better situated than you are to be a part of that kind of global infrastructure revolution. But I think it's got to go hand in hand with an understanding of the cultural and spiritual problems that are going to impact people as a result of this change. For what we're talking about doing, you're talking about moving people over three centuries in a matter of 3 years. And that's what one of these big projects does. We did that with an airport in Atlanta. Georgia is as backward a state as exists in the United States. Until we had a mayor back in the 40s that came up with two ideas. One, he went outside of Atlanta and he bought that land for an airport for $90,000. And he came up with a slogan, a city too busy to hate. He did one other thing. He put up red lights. And he lost the next election. I mean, ideas were too controversial. He finally came back and won the next one and remained mayor for a long time after that. But what that airport did in a very brief period of time